Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo had an interesting question for Wall Street banks today. How big would your bonuses this year be, he asked, if you had never gotten those government bailouts? Fact is, the bonuses this year are plenty big, as is the controversy about them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, today the 11th of January, and it is great to have you here. Wall Street's bonus situation is somewhere between an embarrassment of riches and a looming public relations disaster. Over the next week or so, we are going to hear exactly how big some of those bonuses are going to be, as well as all kinds of explanations about why they are really and truly necessary. We thought we'd spend some time today exploring that side of the argument. Bob Teitelman is the editor-in-chief of The Deal. That's a magazine and a website about Wall Street. Bob, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
The president's spokesman, Robert Gibbs, came out and said once again today that it's the White House's belief that the banks just don't get it about the bonuses, that there is this fundamental disconnect between what happens on Wall Street and the entire rest of the economy. Do you buy that?
I buy that in that there's a disconnect there. What I don't buy is the issue has been so oversimplified over time and reduced to sort of, you know, opposition of Wall Street and Main Street. That's what I don't buy. There is a disconnect because obviously the rest of the country doesn't think Wall Street should get bonuses, and folks on Wall Street believe that they should. So there's a disconnect.
Well, I don't often say this on this program, but go ahead and complicate it for us. What part is the rest of the country missing?
There's a lot of places for these folks to go if they don't get the money that they claim that they deserve at the big banks. And that, you know, you can take that any way you want in terms of whether they deserve it or not, but there's a lot of places for them to go. There's thousands of hedge funds. There's hundreds of private equity firms out there that are not, at this point, under any kind of regulatory oversight from the government.
Let me ask you this, though, and it can roughly be condensed down into the so what question. I mean, it's bad for Lloyd Blankfein and Goldman Sachs if his bankers go somewhere else. But what difference does that really make for the rest of us?
Two of the big issues involving the bonus argument is, one, the too big to fail problem, which is that there are some banks that are too big to fail, and two, that finance is too large for the economy, that we have an overmighty finance establishment. This does not solve either one of those problems. You just shift the talent. You shift it away from regulation, in a sense.
You'll grant that the amounts involved are troubling.
Yes. Yes. They're troubling. Historically, they're troubling. Yes. But that's not, yeah, that's not the issue that I'm really dealing with here.
Yeah. What about the objection from taxpayers that say, listen, there wouldn't be a Wall Street if we hadn't ponied up $700 billion 18 months ago?
You know, if you're going to regulate something like bonuses, you're going to have to regulate them everywhere. You're not going to be able to let anybody get away. It's a little like the healthcare industry, where you get a partial form of regulation. And whenever you get a partial form of regulation, you get a sort of cost shift that goes somewhere else. It goes to the place where it's not regulated. Now, then the question becomes, do you really want to regulate pay across the board in a million different places? And that, because it's a much more difficult issue. And I'm not sure that people have considered that yet.
When you talk to the folks you know on Wall Street, I mean, put me inside their heads. Do they get the public perception disconnect?
Some of them don't. I suspect some of them. You know, some of them do, obviously. But I have spoken to some of them that I have been surprised at how blind they are to the unhappiness out there.
Bob Teitelman, he's the editor-in-chief of The Deal. Bob, thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you.
Labor leaders went to the White House today to talk health care with President Obama, and they are not a happy bunch, those labor leaders. Unions are upset with the president for supporting a tax on what are called Cadillac health plans, plans that a lot of union members happen to enjoy. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Ganser for a primer on how they work and how they affect health care costs for everyone.
The so-called Cadillac plans are luxurious. It's an all-you-can-eat approach to health care. Jerry Katz is a health care analyst at Kurt Solomon Associates.
All-you-can-eat, it's a big buffet at a five-star restaurant.
And someone else is picking up the tab. Employers pay the sky-high premiums. Workers have almost no out-of-pocket expenses. Katz says they tend to go to the doctor a lot, and what their plans pay has a big impact on the rest of us.
So it kind of sets the bar very high. Physicians and hospitals tend to set the prices around the high end of these Cadillac plans.
The Senate health care bill would tax Cadillac plans. The idea is employers would be less likely to offer them. Workers would pay more and use less care. But Georgetown health policy professor Karen Pollitt says that could backfire.
When you ask patients to pay more at the pump, that they will use less care, but that patients will decline care that they need.
Pollitt says that lands them in the emergency room, which costs more in the long run. Vivian Ho disagrees. She's a healthcare economist at Rice University.
You'll still get the care. You'll be more price conscious about it, but I don't think it's going to affect the quality of your care to the extent that you would end up postponing necessary care that could lead you to get sicker later on.
This debate will continue on Capitol Hill. House and Senate negotiators are hoping to get a final health care overhaul bill on the president's desk by late this month or early next. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The average tuition at a private college or university this year is going to run you about $26,000. Steep, but that is before all the extras like food or a place to live or textbooks to study from. Books can easily run you into the hundreds of dollars. But today, Barnes & Noble, one of the biggest operators of college bookstores around the country, said it's going to expand its textbook rental program. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains the announcement does add some momentum to a big shift in the textbook business.
When Barnes & Noble makes a move in the bookselling business, it can have a Walmart effect. Lorraine Shanley is a consultant to the publishing industry.
Nobody's a Walmart except for Walmart, but they're certainly, you take them seriously when they get involved in something like this.
Barnes & Noble has stores on more than 600 college campuses. It's the second largest college bookstore in the country, so there is potential for it to change the business. It's a business that up until now has struggled to grow. But last fall, Barnes & Noble's biggest competitor, Follett, also started renting textbooks, and several smaller companies have been making a go of it lately, too. Kathy Mickey follows the education market at Simba. It's a market research firm for the publishing business. She says Barnes & Noble has to be involved in all areas of the textbook business if it's going to keep making money.
There are certainly a lot of different ways to get college instructional materials distributed in the higher education market, and the people who are interested, the companies that are interested in being primary distributors, such as Barnes & Noble, are going to have to tap all available avenues.
Students will clearly benefit from Barnes & Noble's move, since renting is usually cheaper than buying even used books. Textbook publishers and writers may be less excited. The more students rent, the fewer books they'll buy. And in the Barnes & Noble model, at least, there are no extra royalties for the rentals. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
There wasn't really a whole lot of movement on Wall Street today, but what activity there was pushed the Dow and the S&P to the highest they've been in a good long while. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Beer drinkers can be a particular bunch. So today's news that the Dutch brewer Heineken is going to buy the beer business of the Mexican beverage company FEMSA, it makes Dos Equis, Tecate, and Sol, comes with no small amount of trepidation. Big beer getting even bigger, more homogenous. The nearly $8 billion purchase does make Heineken, the world's number three beer company, even bigger. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the recent wave of macro beer mergers might actually be good for micro brewers.
The little guy is actually doing pretty well. Eric Shepard is executive editor of Beer Marketers Insights. He says overall, U.S. beer sales fell about 2% last year, but craft brews were up 5 or 6%.
It's a phenomenon that everybody's watching very closely. Most of the large beer brands were down in 2009.
Shepard says it's easier to grow when you're small, but he says more drinkers are opting for the flavor and local character of smaller brews. Uli Benevitz owns the Weeping Radish Farm Brewery in Jarvisburg, North Carolina. He also runs a butchery and an organic farm.
Everybody is weary of where does this stuff come from. There is clearly a move towards local, 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 and I think that is an advantage for small breweries.
Analysts say the Heineken-FEMSA deal won't affect the U.S. market much, but big mergers can hurt the little guy. Paul Gatza represents small brewers as director of the Brewers Association. He says when Miller and Molson Coors merged a few years ago, their distributors consolidated too.
So that meant one less wholesaler in each market, which meant fewer choices for the small brewer. In terms of a company that would represent their brands.
But some small brewers got a boost when Belgian giant InBev bought Anheuser-Busch in 2008. Uli Benevitz says InBev wanted to sell its other brands in the U.S. and asked Budweiser distributors to carry imports and microbrews like his, too. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
When you buy a house and you sign those mortgage papers, that's it. You're on the hook for many hundreds of thousands of dollars until the thing is paid off. Unless you decide otherwise. With almost 11 million homeowners underwater in this country, that is paying for a house that's not worth the mortgage, there is a new trend in real estate out there. Just walking away. Roger Lowenstein wrote about it in the New York Times Magazine yesterday. It's good to have you with us.
Kai, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Let's define who we're talking about here. These are people who could conceivably pay, but they're just not.
Yeah, you know, it's a twist on the old-fashioned American nightmare of not being able to pay your mortgage and being forced out and, you know, in the dark of night having to go live with your in-laws or something. What we have now is tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people potentially who could pay their mortgage but are deciding, you know, that darker night doesn't look so bad compared to what I owe. I don't think I'm going to pay it. I think I'm going to pull that trailer up and leave.
You know, you point out that companies do it all the time.
That's right. It's common practice in businesses for business to say, we owe more on this company or on this piece of real estate than it's worth. So rather than keep paying, we'll leave it to the bank or whoever the creditor is. Let them worry about it.
So here's the point where I reveal my bias. When I read your piece, I said a couple of things. One was, wait, what about their credit ratings? That'll just be terrible. And the other one was, man, what about the shame and public opprobrium of just walking away from this debt that you signed on to?
Is it really right to say that they're immoral? Both administrations, both of the recent ones, the Bush administration, Hank Paulson, and even Obama recently has called on people to do what they call the responsible thing. Hank Paulson even said people who walk away from their homes are no better than speculators, which is kind of amusing because Hank Paulson spent 32 years at Goldman Sachs, where presumably once in a while they speculated on something or other, right? In my view, you're not a social pariah. You're not any worse than the company that gave you the mortgage and probably flipped it about 5 minutes later.
Well, about those banks and the folks who gave you the mortgage, is there a chance that if a lot of people did this, it would actually fix the housing market faster? It would change lending standards and it would get the foreclosures through the system and all that stuff?
The theory is that if enough people said, we're not afraid of the opprobrium or the social shame or whatever, we're not going to pay, the banks would say, you know, I think we have to renegotiate with these people because otherwise we're going to have a tidal wave on our hands. So that's the theory.
Let me argue the flip side of the argument you make that it might actually fix the housing market faster. It is just flat not a very neighborly thing to do because once your house falls into foreclosure, it looks bad, property values around it go bad, and it just makes the whole market in that neighborhood go down the toilet.
That's true. You know, if I'm your neighbor, I'd rather you kept paying on your mortgage. On the other hand, if you think about what happened to the housing market in the late '00s, it was financialized. It was turned from just people's homes to financial assets. People got mortgages that were worth far more than the homes were worth. They were given, you know, home equity deals so they could take money out of them. The banks and society began to treat homes like any other financial asset. With any other financial asset, if you want to buy oil futures, say, it may have a bad effect on me because I may have to pay more for gasoline tomorrow. But that's sort of how the system works, right?
It does sort of take that idea of home ownership out of the American dream, though, doesn't it? I mean, it just commoditizes it in a way that I think we're not used to hearing about when you're talking about this place you own.
Well, in Europe, they have very strong communities. They have much lower rates of home ownership. People rent their homes, but they're very connected to their communities. The philosophy here has been all we need is for people to own their homes, P.S., whether they could afford them or not. Well, maybe that's the best way to build neighborhoods, but maybe it's not.
Roger Lowenstein, he's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's got a new book coming out in April. It's called The End of Wall Street. Mr. Lowenstein, thanks so much for your time.
Kai, it was a pleasure.
Coming up, getting pecked to death by Big Chicken.
The poultry company and my relationship is like a partnership, except that they own 51% of the stock. Whatever they say goes.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped 0.4% today. 45 points ended at 10,663. The S&P 500 popped up 0.1%. 2 points, finished at 1146. Both indices hit 15-month highs, by the by. Not so the NASDAQ. It gave back 0.2%. 4 points, closed at 2312. All eyes were on Alcoa as it kicked off the quarterly earnings season, but the aluminum maker earned just 1 cent a share. That missed expectations. Shares were off 5% in after-hours trading. After big gains last week, tech investors took their money and ran. Amazon gave back nearly 2.5% today. Software giant Microsoft deleted 1.25%. Apple sliced off more than 0.75%. Bond prices nearly flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note hit 3.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratch Pad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its monthly report on international trade for November. Pavement management is just one of many topics at the Transportation Research Board 89th annual meeting, continuing in Washington. And Jeff Bezos turns 46. He founded that great big store online, Amazon.com. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Optimism is the operative phrase in Detroit, Michigan this week. The North American International Auto Show opened its doors today. Lots of hybrids and electric prototypes among the flashy new models on the floor. And a good number of them are going to have to catch on if American car makers are going to recapture at least a hint of their former glory. Paul Ingrassia was the Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal for many years. And in his new book, Crash Course, he points out that Detroit was destroyed by its own success. So I asked him whether failure and the luxuries of bankruptcy court may save it in the long run.
Well, on paper, yes. The question is, can they seize the chance? But on paper, you know, General Motors' debt was reduced from about $55 billion to $17 billion. The company is shedding 4 of its 8 brands. It had way too many brands for its shrunken market share, less than 25% of the market. So they're coming out looking terrific on paper. The question is, can they make you really want to own a Chevy again? Can they make you really want to own a Cadillac again? And that remains to be seen. They have to execute, they have to get the quality right, and they have to get some passion back into those cars.
How much time do you think Detroit has? I mean, do they have 3 years, 5 years, a decade? to sort of mess
around? A decade's way too long. We're going to know this in the next 3 to 5 years, probably the next three, to be honest with you.
Hmm. And so what's it going to look like at the end of 3 years? I mean, how are we going to know whether Detroit's back? Just sales?
Well, yes, sales and market share, clearly, and, you know, profits in the end. You have to have profits, too. Now, you know, one thing that will really change about the structure of the industry, you know, we're used to talking for decades about the big three. Mm-hmm. You can just wipe the term big three out of your vocabulary. We're going to have a medium six, if you will, which is the structure they've had in Europe for a long time. And so the medium six, you know, the big three, General Motors had 50% of the market, Ford had about 25%, and Chrysler had about 12 or 13%. Those days are gone. You're going to have about six companies with somewhere between 8 and 20% or maybe 8 and 18% of the market. And so there's going to be a lot more competition. There's not going to be one leader in technology or hybrids or styling or the kind of consumer electronics they're putting in the car. There's going to be a lot of stuff, a lot of choice out there for consumers.
Let me turn to the politics of this thing for a second. Back in February, March, and April, obviously a lot of talk about what the government was doing, the bailouts they were giving, and then the deadlines for bankruptcy.
Right.
What do you think of what the Obama administration did? You know, putting the car companies on a tight deadline and then saying, listen, it's put up or shut up.
Well, first of all, I have a confession to make if I can.
Sure.
I'm a Republican.
Okay.
I thought this whole thing to begin with was a bad idea, and I got even worse feelings about it when they announced the members of the Automotive Task Force. They weren't really announced. They just sort of came together. But frankly, I think the Obama administration and the Automotive Task Force did a very good job on this. They really quite quickly grasped some issues that people in Detroit knew all along but were afraid to face up to. GM has way too many brands. 8 brands is too many. The jobs bank that paid UAW workers indefinitely for not working when they were laid off was ridiculous. So all that stuff has gotten wiped away right now, and it really was the work of the Automotive Task Force. Now, the downside is it cost you and me and the rest of the taxpayers $100 billion or more.
We ever going to see that money again?
No.
Not ever.
We'll see some of it, but we're not going to see all $100 billion of it, to be honest with you. So the only justification for doing it was basically this. Would the damage to the U.S. economy a year ago, in the wake of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the collapse of Wall Street, if GM and Chrysler would have simply collapsed, would that have been far worse for the economy than the cost of $100 billion bailout? I think in the case of GM, the answer was pretty clearly yes. Chrysler, it was a very close call. The Obama administration people were very divided on Chrysler, and in the end, the president made the call himself to save Chrysler.
Paul Ingrassi covered Detroit for the Wall Street Journal for many years. He's got a new book out about that city and its industry. Crash Course, it's called, The American Automobile Industry's Road from Glory to Disaster. Mr. Ingrassi, thanks so much for your time.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
About that grilled chicken you ate for lunch today. You know, most of us are a long way removed from the business end of the food chain in this country. And I mean the business end, not the how a chicken turns into KFC end. New Department of Agriculture rules went into effect New Year's Day. They're supposed to make sure chicken farmers get a fair shake from the giant poultry companies that they have to do business with. But some of those chicken growers say the USDA help came a little bit too late. Kate Archer Kent of Red River Radio reports.
The market for chicken is built on trust. The poultry company delivers its fuzzy yellow chicks to the farmer when they're a day old. The farmer acts as a contractor to the poultry industry. He gives the fledgling brood just the right amount of food, water, and warmth. Then, 7 weeks later, the poultry company returns and trucks the chickens off to the processing plant. That cycle happens over and over, but sometimes the farmer gets an unsettling call. The current flock will be his last.
It just knocked the wind out of you. You just can't hardly get back up on your feet.
Rhett Henry of El Dorado, Arkansas, is a third-generation poultry farmer. When Pilgrim's Pride closed its El Dorado plant last year, Henry's farm and 170 others went dark.
My chickens were 2 days old at that time. We were anticipating something, but nothing quite that drastic.
Henry's high-tech barns were computerized to provide the perfect growing conditions. Neighboring farmers made similar investments, counting on a ready supply of flocks. Inside Kevin Hux's poultry barn, stray feathers and manure are all that remain. Huxenstalt rows and rows of new drinking nipples for what turned out to be his last flock. The $5,000 upgrade never paid off.
They just had us keep spending and had us keep going, and they knew. They had to know that this didn't happen overnight. They had to know this fixing to shut down.
The USDA's new regulations may have helped farmers like Kevin Hux. Among the new rules, farmers must have a contract before they build chicken houses. Companies can no longer add confidentiality clauses to those contracts. Those stipulations barred farmers from disclosing terms of the deal with lawyers or even family members. And the poultry company must give at least 90 days' notice before cutting ties with the farmer. Poultry giants like Tyson's and Pilgrim's Pride defer to the National Chicken Council for comment. Here's the council's Richard Lobb.
The things envisioned in the rule are primarily being done already by the companies in their contracts with the growers, so we don't expect this will be any big or radical change.
Lobb says the poultry companies support the USDA's action, with one caveat. He says giving a farmer 90 days' notice before terminating a contract is excessive.
The flock only lives for 42 to 49 days. So that puts the companies in kind of a tough position to notify the farmer that he's going to be canceled.
Won't we walk out in them?
These are the collective peeps of 20,000 baby chicks on John Harson's farm in Haynesville, Louisiana. He raises chickens for foster farms. Harson has been a grower for 30 years. He says his dealings with the poultry companies have always been amicable, as long as he understood the arrangement.
The poultry company and my relationship is like a partnership, except that they own 51% of the stock. Whatever they say goes.
Farmers here are still hoping the local processing plant reopens. The normally stable chicken market was hurt during the recession. The National Chicken Council is forecasting a rebound as the economy recovers and people eat out more and order up the chicken cordon bleu. From the Louisiana-Arkansas border, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, let's say for just a second you are President Obama. You're working on your budget for next year. You really want to reduce the deficit. And you know the public's not all that happy with the banking industry. So what do you do? If a senior administration official talking to reporters today is to be believed, you impose a new fee on those banks. Not a fee on transactions, as has been widely discussed. Also, not a fee on bonuses. So details are sketchy, as you can tell. Still, the desire to make those banks pay something could go a real long way. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow up 45 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ dropped 4 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained 2 points. That is 0.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast, a new kind of surgery for all kinds of problems.
Orthopedics, ear, nose, and throat, ophthalmology, pain management services, urology.
You get where we're going on this one, right? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.